Good afternoon. Welcome to today's edition of the Daily Friend Show. I'm your host, Maurice Ritz. I'm standing in for Nicholas Larimer, who's taken leave for today. So don't worry if you're missing Mr. Larimer's dulcet tones. He'll be back on Wednesday. But I'm joined by two of my colleagues, Terence Corrigan. Good afternoon, Terence.
Afternoon. How are you?
I'm all right, yourself?
You're good.
And also with the indefatigable Harriman Pretorius. Harriman, good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Marius. I'm putting indefatigable on my CV now.
You should. I think it's very true. So it's you wouldn't be lying if you did put it on there. So but yeah.
Well,
so
something on my CV must be true. So I'll try.
No worries. You can say that you're in high school villain pets. So there we go.
No, absolutely no.
But anyway, so we've got a bit to talk about this afternoon. One of the what we'll be kicking off with is that Khaled Khachalia, who is DA MP, he just tweeted that the DA has in its possession a document which shows that talking about a macro reorganization of the state and using the opportunity of the COVID-19 pandemic. And one of the more scary things it says is that the National Command Council could become a permanent structure and in a way to reorganize the government and run the country. Terence, do you want to tell us a little bit about this? Terence, you're still on the mute.
Sorry about that. We've received what purports to be this document. It's not 100% clear whether or not it's genuine. There are a few things that pique my skepticism. There's some very obvious grammar errors and there's a top secret written at the top. But be that as it may, the idea that the Coronavirus Command Council will, you know, become a model for future governance, I don't think this is entirely beyond the ballpark of possibilities. Certainly not in the medium term. You must remember we're on level three now, and despite legal challenges and no one really knowing who is on this this command council. Has that information ever been put forward? I think that it's a remarkably attractive option for a political party that I think has a very strong strain of a command impulse about it. We're on level three. That means that we'd have to transit through level two and through level one. Level one doesn't mean that we're out, that we're finished. It simply means we're on level one. And I think that the prospects that we could be stuck in some sort of coronavirus emergency for the next year, maybe 2 years, is not entirely implausible. And I think what these circumstances done is it's extended a great deal of discretionary power, which would not ordinarily be possible. And I think that there is a great deal of evidence that certain of our ministers, who we presume are on this command council, are enjoying it way too much. Also South Africa was in a crisis before this hit. This gives a great deal of latitude. And in a way enables the government to sort of dodge responsibility for in terms of governing according to normal legal strictures. So yes, very very concerning should this turn out to be accurate, or some version of this be seriously under consideration.
Well, we've seen that a lot of the people in our government hold parliament in contempt, really. I mean, that's the only word you can use for it. I'm just thinking about Nkosi Zana Dlamini Zuma, the Minister for Corporate Governance and Traditional Affairs, and who's also the Prime Minister, if you believe some people. She recently she answered a number of parliamentary questions by just saying this information is not available at this time. And then DA, quite cleverly, they asked the minister if they could tell the country which municipality the capital of the country is in. Obviously, that's China. And the minister answered with that information is not available at this time. So obviously, she and her staff were just, you know, dismissing all every question with just that answer. And just, I mean, it's scary and shows that there's, you know, as you say, in the DNA of the governing party, there is kind of a contempt for democracy often. And I think this kind of instinct for, you know, a centralized control. What do you think, Cameron?
Yeah, no, definitely. I think if this doesn't turn out to be a legitimate document, I've scanned read through it, but very, very briefly. I mean, there's nothing really ideological or policy-wise in this document that would sound weird coming from the ANC as we've gotten to know it. It's very much, you know, there's a problem, what's the answer? Government. Well, there's a problem, what's the answer? More government power, centralized decision-making, more intervention. There's no idea here of, you know, liberty of communities knowing better what their own needs and desires and constraints are, and decentralization. It really wouldn't surprise me if this is a legitimate document, but Terence is very right in that it might not be. It is the responsible thing to do to try and understand what the source of this document is that we've received. But it really it wouldn't be a strange step at all ideologically for a more centralized command of statal structure to become the ambition of the ANC. And the question now is just really, will South Africans be willing to understand and learn from this lockdown period that ideology really, really matters? Because these are ideological questions. What's the role of the state? Who's in charge of the economy? Is someone in charge of the economy? Nothing in this document really cries, you know, this is obviously blatantly ideologically inconsistent with what the ANC wants, but we'll see.
Yeah, look, just so, you know, on the parliamentary question, I think you raise a very important issue, and this concerns about the attitude of the executive towards parliament go back to the 1990s. You know, I think that things become very brazen when you are clearly not even bothering to read the questions. But I remember, I think it was back in 1997 or so, 1998. There was a Workers' Day advert put out, which appeared in the Sowetan, if I remember correctly. And it said, "Workers of South Africa, you have much to celebrate. The passage of the Skills Development Bill and the passage." Apparently, these bills hadn't even made it to Parliament yet. You know, and we've seen under Thabo Mbeki taking advantage. At least he was quite clever in it, taking advantage of grammatical lapses in the questions to dodge answering them at all. There was one where someone had confused the DRC, I think, with the Port Elizabeth Metro, and he said, "Well, I don't know what's going to happen in Kinshasa." But you know, there also been some very serious questions. I remember one about the use of government money to print T-shirts with things with Jacob Zuma's face, and the response was, "We do this to show our patriotism." avoiding the substance, and I think that that the current arrangement is actually very good for that, where Parliament can, be disregarded on the grounds that we're in an emergency. And, you know, Charles de Gaulle said, Parliament's paralyzed politics.
I think one of probably the biggest failures of post-apartheid South Africa, especially since the 90s, has been that Parliament has basically just been a rubber stamp. I mean, that's obviously partly because the ANC has won every election since 1994 fairly easily. And apart from the DA, and I mean, you could even argue the EFF, even if you don't necessarily like the tactics, have been the parties that have kind of, you know, tried to keep an eye on what's happening in the government. But I think perhaps if we do ever get to a time where coalition government at national level becomes a norm, maybe, you know, we'll see a bit more parliamentary oversight. And I think another issue is that immediately after 1994, the ANC's parliamentary caucus was incredibly strong. There were a lot of, you know, good people who'd been in exile, whatever the case was, were involved in the transition, who became MPs. because there weren't really that many opportunities for them as yet, as the country was still, you know, first becoming a democracy. And as soon as, you know, the opportunities open up in business or academia or whatever, then the parliamentary, the ANC parliamentary party became fairly gutted. I mean, I challenge anybody listening to this now to name one good ANC MP, if they can. Somebody that they think, you know, works hard in parliament and holds the executive to account. I bet you, if you think of an MP, it'll be a DA or an EFF person, or maybe somebody from the Freedom Front Plus, or whatever the case is, maybe even the ACDP, but certainly won't be an ANC MP.
And I think part of the problem is something that we've been looking at in recent weeks, is electoral reform. I know there are many people who are skeptical about electoral reform as a way of getting accountability back into politics. But I kind of have this attitude that, you know, we can't do nothing. It might not, electoral reform might not be, you know, the silver bullet, but at least it's a bullet, because currently, you know, the we're just unarmed in terms of trying to get some form of accountability into Parliament. And Marius, you and I have spoken about this. How powerful could it have been in Parliament if the constituency MP for Collins Kozak could have said, Mr. President or Mr. Deputy President or Minister or Speaker, my constituent Collins Kozak was murdered by this government, and I will not sit down, I will not relinquish this microphone or whatever until I get answers that will satisfy my constituents. Because we have to acknowledge that the initial, this electoral dominance that you speak about is really a continuation of the election or the electoral system that was only actually to be, you know, quite a temporary thing, this whole proportional, full proportional representation. But it is very telling that there's this accountability vacuum in South Africa, and the ANC is probably going to exploit it. And if, I mean, I always am very skeptical when people say, oh, Zimbabwe or Venezuela for South Africa. But I mean, you have to look where the ANC looks for inspiration. And the Venezuelan government or the Maduro government's really idea to get around not even having a majority in the legislature there, and the creation of, I think, some constitutional council or something. Mm-hmm. I mean, it really, really does echo some National Coronavirus Command Council sentiments. There's a crisis, centralized power and a new body, and voila, that is suddenly now the new cabinet or the new government. I don't like to tell spook stories, but there is something really, really unsettling about the National Coronavirus Command Council. And if we have any indication that this council will have a shelf life longer than the coronavirus crisis itself, South Africans should not be surprised, and should be very clear about that, about what that means for constitutional democracy.
I agree. But so it looks like, whether those documents are real or not, I think we can all agree it would not surprise any of us if it is real. And it's something we need to keep an eye open. I mean, democracy is something that we always have to be be fierce in protecting. And I think then there's nefarious elements who aren't the greatest fans of democracy in this country. I don't think we need to be, eternally vigilant. That was the word I was looking for. So, but moving on to another part of the world where democracy is in full retreat, is tell us a bit about what's been happening in China, Terence, and Chinese saber-rattling and trying to, you know, kind of expand the influence.
Well, yeah. This, I think, has been one of the great geopolitical stories of this year, and I think it's trailed the coronavirus issue, largely because I think that the Chinese leadership saw that with the world's attention distracted, they were going to be able to move with a kind of pace and aggression that would not otherwise be possible. Now, on the 30th of June, the new security law came into effect in Hong Kong, and I think within 24 hours that arrested something like 10 people under its provisions. Interesting thing about that, which is not featured much in the commentary about that here, is that the law actually has a sort of extraterritorial dimension. In other words, one doesn't have to be a Chinese or a Hong Kong resident or even citizen to fall foul of it. And there's been concerns that activists from other parts of the world could, you know, visiting Hong Kong could be arrested on the basis that they had been colluded, you know, been sponsoring terrorist activities or whatever. So that's the first thing. We have suggestions now about setting up a Hong Kong parliament in exile. Came from a guy named Simon Cheng. There've been suggestions from Australia, the United Kingdom, Taiwan to perhaps establish some sort of special vehicle which would give refugee essentially give refugee and resident status to people from Hong Kong. And in the case of the UK, that could extend up to about 3 million people who still have that that old Hong Kong British overseas citizenship. Canada, I know, has now has warned its citizens against visiting because of the possibility of arbitrary arrest. This is big news. Mm. Now, but you know, in a way, you could say, well, you know, Hong Kong is a sort of Chinese internal affair. But we've seen increasing Chinese Chinese saber rattling with India, for instance. For those South Africans who think that that BRICS is the future, bear in mind two members of BRICS have actually been shooting at each other with a loss of life. Interesting thing, this morning, I think today it's the Dalai Lama's birthday, and a number of high-profile Indian politicians tweeted birthday greetings, which is something that they've been very cagey about doing in the past. Despite the fact that the Tibetan government exile is in India, the Indian government has been a bit standoffish about that. All of a sudden, one of them was the lieutenant government of the area where the skirmishes took place. This could perhaps signal some sort of reset. The other interesting thing is that Australia has just revamped its defence policy, which is very, very clearly directed at defending itself from China. It's not so much that they're budgeting more money or looking at expanding. Australia, you know, has a sort of high tech defence force.
I thought that the Australians relied on boomerangs and cricket bats. Is that untrue? Is that a stereotype I'm thinking of?
I think that there are probably neighbourhoods in Sydney where that would be, you know, a particularly frightening thing, particularly if you're sort of waving around a Springbok banner, you know, after a particularly unfortunate rugby match. But no, you're talking about long-range ship-to-ship missiles. What they've essentially done is they've said that they're going to plan on a 10-year basis as opposed to a 4-year basis, which means that the Australian Defence Force knows in advance what it's going to be able to send. And the very interesting thing about this from a defense point of view is that they're looking at extending their sonar and radar systems in directions that they weren't previously oriented because those were considered to be just no danger zones, and acquiring very long range anti-ship missiles. And it doesn't take a genius to know exactly what that signifies. In fact, Australia sent one warship up to support the Americans in one of these disputed islands, they've also said that, you know, Australia has to now take seriously the possibility of a conventional war. This was just not something anyone was thinking about. You know, the last time Australia was really involved in something like that was the Gulf War, but as a very minor participant, mm-hmm. the troops in Vietnam. But the idea that you're going to be fighting with tanks and everything for your survival, that's World War II type stuff. But the other thing, as I understand, is that China is... Well, I was saying China apparently also has some designs on Vladivostok.
Yes.
So, you know, it's as far as this BRICS arrangement goes, well, there's Brazil, which is too far away, and South Africa, which they could probably take in an afternoon. But there's sort of cannons pointing from China at two of its BRICS partners. Now, these are nuclear armed states. This is not a happy situation.
But I also read that apparently there's the thinking in the U.S. military at the moment at the top levels is that the Americans would likely lose a conventional war against the Chinese if they went to war now. So that's also, it's quite something. I mean, it's probably the first time that Americans, I mean, they were beaten by a bunch of Vietnamese peasants in the 70s. But we'll have to see if they'd, you know, how this would influence the thinking and so on. And also, I mean, we've been reading about, you know, all kinds of horrible things happening in Western China with the Uyghur people, apparently forced sterilizations and all kinds of really, really awful stuff. So I think, I mean, I don't know if it's an exaggeration, but China might be the biggest threat to global peace since the Nazis, possibly. What do you think, Adam?
I think the chances of that are quite high if you're a Tibetan man. Okay, right. That was a very odd joke. But I'll stop. I'll stop now. No, I think if the real question mark that I kind of see when I look at these developments is this question: is China on the ascendancy, or are they up? Are they going up, or are they going down? Because you have these two definite schools of thought. That, you know, China is about to take over the world, but then you also very strongly have reasons to believe that China is actually quite in a weak state at the moment. So it depends on I guess who you ask, but there is this question as to are we seeing a restructuring of a new global order, if I could use such a grandiose term. I think we are. The question is just, is China a strong play in that, gaining strength, or are they a player gaining weakness? And some of my colleagues within the Institute are not completely, you know, opposed to the idea that China is playing the coronavirus crisis very well to destabilize its traditional geopolitical opponents. But then on the other hand, you also have the problem of China is itself not quite yet in the clear from the virus. So, yeah, no, I wish I could say something more useful than that. but genuinely, it is a question, and we're going to see the creation of new power allegiances, and it would be interesting to see where South Africa would position itself, and I don't think there's any real question as to where we would.
But I'm not one of these people who thinks that the Chinese made the coronavirus on purpose or released it, you know. But I do think they have, as you said, been taking advantage of this turmoil that this disease has caused in the world, and I think they're taking advantage of it.
Yeah, I don't.
No, of course, certainly not. Yeah, but. No, I wasn't implying that you did say that.
But I think it definitely is geopolitical opportunism that they are weakening. I mean, just look at what's happening in the United States. I mean, the Chinese government must be so chuffed that Winnie the Pooh is probably eating some honey somewhere.
No, exactly. And I wouldn't be surprised if there is some agitation from within China about, you know, I mean, we saw what happened with these Russian bots and so on before the 2016 US election where it was clear that Russian bots or these server farms in Russia were supporting Donald Trump hashtags and so on Twitter. I wouldn't be surprised. I know BLM is an organic movement and so on, but I wouldn't be surprised if there is some kind of, you know, PSYOPs things going around with it as well, just to take advantage of this kind of stuff. But I mean, that's just speculation on my part. So, but sticking with the coronavirus theme, seems that Gauteng is seeming to reaching its peak. It seems we've overtaken the Western Cape. And the Western Cape, if you look at deaths and so on, is actually maybe coming out of its peak, which is good news for our Catonian friends. But Herman, do you want to tell us a bit about what the Gauteng government is thinking via provincial lockdown, possibly? Herman, are you there?
Hi. Yes.
Yes.
Sorry. No, I am here.
Sorry there for a second.
Yeah. No. It's not that cold, so I hope that my line didn't freeze because of the weather. No. It is a fascinating question, but I mean, this issue poses so many questions. Firstly, we knew this was coming. I mean, the whole purpose of the initial lockdown was to flatten the curve, to push back the peak, and to have the peak or to have the real crisis time begin in July and then peak in September. That was the whole reasoning, as I understood it, at least. So now we are hitting that, that time of increasing numbers and turbulence. So why anyone would be panicking now, especially if you're a government minister or a provincial government official, I'm unsure. I mean, we knew this was coming. This was the whole purpose of the lockdown in the first place, so that we can prepare for exactly a time such as this. And this morning, the spokesperson for the Gauteng government may said no, they are not calling for a return to hard lockdown, even though the health MEC of Gauteng recently seemed to say that they are. So you've got that uncertainty. But then also you kind of have to ask the question, this isn't a surprise. No one should be surprised by this. We knew this was coming. If you are not ready now, if you have to take drastic knee-jerk actions or decisions now, why on God's good earth is that necessary? Why is anything knee-jerk? We knew exactly what was going to happen. That was the purpose of the lockdown in the first place. And if we are having knee-jerk reactions now, especially in Gauteng, then what on earth was the purpose of the lockdown in the first place? So it's that discrepancy that really frustrates me here. And then you also run into the difficulty of imagine the lockdown was only announced now. That would have made a lot of sense. You would have gotten a lot of goodwill from the people. But by now, people are hopeful for this lockdown. Mm-hmm. So any rules that you might implement now to try and slow the spread or flatten the curve, they will just, you know, not have the same traction they would have had if it's the diminishing returns. So I must say that the Gauteng taking over the Western Cape, we knew that was going to happen. The ANC was just lack of opportunistic, saying, oh, look at the DA-governed Western Cape, such a disaster zone. Yes, they're 2-3 weeks ahead of us on this, so they are going to peak 2-3 weeks ahead of this. But nothing about this should surprise any government official. And the fact that we get this sense of panic now just shows that these people really didn't do their jobs the first time around.
No, exactly. We know the Eastern Cape will overtake Gauteng in the next 2 or 3 weeks, possibly. And it's, I mean, and obviously each in the different parts of the country, this pandemic is working its way, in different ways and so on. But I mean, you know, none of this, as you say, none of this should shock anybody. We all knew Gauteng was going to get its peak at some point, sometime after Western Cape. And it really is opportunistic of the ANC also saw people on social media saying this is some kind of governance failure because of the DA. But I mean, we all knew what was going to happen. And we've also already seen terrible things in the Eastern Cape with overflowing hospitals and, you know, people lying in the passage with, you know, no beds and not being able to breathe and so on. So yeah, it's not a great situation for anyone. Do you have any thoughts on that, Terrence?
Yeah, you know, I just come back to, you know, how long does this go on for? You know, the hard lockdown, and I would say actually, I think there was a great deal of goodwill and understanding, and lots of people cut the government a lot of slack. Look, you know, because of particular health challenges in my household, I mean, this is very personal to me. But I think that when we look back, you know, when the fog of the present has lifted somewhat, I think that the big issue is going to be, you know, did we use that time adequately, or was it squandered, for political expediency and political bombast? I mean, did we, as a country, did we cut proper agreements between the public and private sectors, get the necessary equipment in, or, you know, was it all about, you know, I'm gonna go after you for buying a box of cigarettes, and you know you may not visit your auntie. Mm-hmm. I think there's been way too much sort of gregarious, bombastic reveling in power. I did read something the other day by Alex van Nieuwe saying that the Western Cape is the only province that really has established a kind of cooperative protocol between the public and private sectors. No one else seems to have done that. One would assume that, you know, if you want the state to take the lead, which is what President Ramaphosa said, public sector testing should be galloping ahead of that being done by the private sector. But as far as I'm aware, more is still being done by the private sector, and you know that calls into question more than just this pandemic, but the whole failure of governance.
I'm open to correction, but I do think that the public and private testing is about the same, but just takes quite a while longer to get your test back from the public sector and the private sector, which kind of defeats the object of testing and tracing and so on. If it takes you a week or 10 days to get told you've had COVID and you're asymptomatic, whatever the case is, you've been walking around spreading it, going to the shops and that. So that kind of defeats the object. But as you say, I think it's symptomatic of a couple of governance failures. Yeah, and I think the government squandered enormous amounts of goodwill with silly lockdown rules and bans on tobacco and so on, and not being able to walk your dog and whatever. And also, I mean, even worse things. I mean, Collins causes death, Pietrus Michels getting killed. You know, these are, you know, that not being able to walk your dog doesn't really matter when we have, citizens getting beaten to death by soldiers because they broke a lockdown or didn't even break a lockdown. But anyway, now, Herman, final thoughts.
Yeah, no, I must say that it one of the frustrations for me now with the government, the MEC for Health in Gauteng seeming to say one thing and then the government spokesperson saying another thing, it just really shows that the ANC doesn't have any interest in understanding what a small business owner is going through. If you have a business that you need to run. I've spent some of the days in the last few weeks speaking to small business owners about this. They really, of course, they want an open economy, but if they can't get, then at least they want certainty. They want you have a set number of resources that you must implement, and if you know that you have a specific time frame that you can plan for, at least you can mitigate some of the damage to your business. But if we have this uncertainty, are we going to go to level four, back to level four, level five in Gauteng? Oh no, we're not. Oh, but we might be. It really just weighs down on people who have to make tough decisions to save jobs that ultimately turn on whether they can save their business. And, you know, that type of certainty, it's incredibly cruel of the government to not even give them that.
Mm. I think this is this whole COVID epidemic has shown that some significant gaps in the government's ability to govern South Africa, which even, it's a big, diverse place with lots of challenges. So you really need to be, a capable government. And unfortunately, we don't have that at the moment. And a lot of the problems that South Africa has, or the vast majority of them, are self-inflicted. So, but I think that's all we have time for today. Thanks, guys. It was an interesting conversation. If anybody's listening here, please remember to like and share the podcast and so on. And if you enjoy our work, read, go to the Daily Friend as well. All our writing is there. Terence is a regular contributor there, and myself and Herman also write occasionally. So go have a look. And if you like the work that the Institute of Race Relations does, you can join on our website, or you can also SMS your name to the number 32823, and one of our colleagues in our call center will give you a call. So yeah, thanks. That's all we have time for today, and that's the Monday edition. And Nick Lorimer will be back with you on Wednesday. Thanks a lot, guys. Cheers.